Hello, I'm Jeffrey Sachs. Welcome to Book Club, a monthly conversation with world-leading authors who have written scintillating, inspiring, and remarkably important books about history, social justices, and the challenges of building a decent world. Welcome to Book Club with Jeffrey Sachs. I am absolutely thrilled to be joined today by Lindsay O'Rourke, Associate Professor of Political Science at Boston College and non-resident fellow at the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. And we're discussing a wonderful, really a remarkably important book, Covert Regime Change. Very apropos and extremely important, that Lindsay published in 2018. And it is a comprehensive study of American-led regime change operations during the Cold War period. And it's got enormous relevance for everything about modern geopolitics and our current travails and issues as well. So, Lindsay, thank you so much for joining the book club. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
Tell us about this incredible project. First, just to say, the book is about covert regime change, so covert, secret.
Yes.
You have written a book about secretive actions by the United States government during the Cold War period, and you document dozens of cases. So I'd like to understand the project, how you developed this comprehensive view. How does one study covert operations? And give us some definitions so that everybody listening from around the world knows the category of things that you are investigating in this book.
Okay, wonderful. Thank you. The definition of a covert regime change is an operation to replace the political leadership or change the regime type of a foreign state where the intervening state does not intend for its role to be publicly acknowledged. So the heart of covert action is the idea of plausible deniability and that it's somehow concealed so that the intervening state's role is hidden. So in my study, I talk about, you know, five different tactics: assassinations, sponsoring coups, meddling in foreign elections, trying to promote popular revolutions, and covertly supporting foreign armed groups in their armed bids to overthrow a state. So obviously, with that definition, it's easy to see the problem studying that, namely that states try to conceal their role in it. So the idea behind my project, which came out of my dissertation, was
dissertation, if I'm correct, with our friend John Mearsheimer,
yes.
Your advisor, John,
yes.
Mearsheimer. So yeah. The great realist.
yes.
And you did a PhD on regime change. One thing just to start, it's an incredibly important topic because the U.S. does it a lot done it a lot. But your book is, I think, the only one I know of a comprehensive study of covert regime change. So how can that be, by the way? It's so important, but it's not. It is not central for political scientists.
Yeah. Well, I think the problem with studying it for a long time is that when you talk about these things, a lot of people tend to hear conspiracy theories. It's hard to systematically talk about it or authoritatively talk about it just because of the backlash you might get. And so what I tried to do with my dissertation in the book was I did a ton of archival research in which I came up with declassified government documents to prove each of the cases in my book. So I had a standard. I had to have at least three primary source government documents saying that this was, in fact, a covert regime change attempt. And because of the 25-year time lag, I felt like I could do the entire Cold War. I don't think I got every case, but I think I got a lot. And ultimately, what I came up with was 64 covert regime change attempts during the Cold War. 25 of these succeeded and brought the U.S.-backed forces to power, and the other 39 failed.
So before we get to the cases, these are, every one of them, in some sense, a conspiracy, obviously.
Yes, yeah.
So I always say, if you don't believe in conspiracies, you just don't get it. you know, conspiracy theories have a bad name in the U.S., and you're regarded kind of as a kook if you deal yeah. in conspiracy theories. But I think it's extremely important. You have 64 cases of the U.S. trying, and in some cases succeeding, in overthrowing other countries' governments, every one of which, to my mind, would qualify legally as a conspiracy.
That's true.
It's a lot, actually. So I just want to encourage people to believe in conspiracies, not every conspiracy that they hear of, but to understand that governments operate secretly.
Yes.
And some governments with a lot of power, like the United States, the government we're talking about, has a lot of power. And it has a tradition of secrecy, actually, in foreign policy.
That's true. Actually, even if you look at my cases, you can think of it as a covert campaign. So oftentimes it involved many different covert tactics. Like Cuba is my case from 1960 to 1968. But during that time, we had paramilitary assault with the Bay of Pigs. We had an assassination program and we had coup attempts. So there's actually many more covert actions than just 64 cases.
And that, by the way, is counted as one case, that
exactly,
8 years.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's almost a full-time job, this conspiracy business, actually. It is kind of incredible to me. So differentiate between overt and covert, because you talk about 6 overt regime
yes.
change operations and 64 covert regime change operations. And to keep everybody's mind on this focus, your data covers the period 1947 to 1989, I believe.
Yes, that's correct.
Which is the kind of classic Cold War period, because by 1989, the Cold War was ending in Central and Eastern Europe. I happened to be involved already in the regime changes, not as a covert agent, I have to say, but as an economist,
yes.
in 1989 in Poland and in a number of other countries. So you take that period. What are these 6 overt regime change cases, and what's the difference of overt and covert regime change?
So the overt cases are just the cases where the United States did not intend to publicly to conceal its role. So Grenada, Panama, Lebanon, when we crossed the 38th parallel during the Korean War. So these were just, you know, public known attempts to overthrow a government.
And 6 of those took place on your count during the Cold War period, and 64 somewhat secret. Because one thing that comes to mind immediately, if a president of another country is assassinated or there's a coup, it's a little hard to keep everything secret, isn't it?
Yes, quite hard. I found that in 70% of my cases, the U.S. was actually accused of overthrowing the country at the time of the operation. And in many more cases, they actually knew that the U.S. was trying to overthrow them, but they kept it secret because they didn't want to reveal any weakness that they had. So it's incredibly difficult to keep secret.
Especially when you're overthrowing a government, actually.
Exactly, yeah.
Because that's a pretty public event in a way. But I mean, I have some questions about that because I know of cases. And I think one we should talk about later on is when the Ukrainian president was overthrown in February 2014.
Yes.
Well, we'll come back to that because was that a U.S. operation or not is still debated very much. So that's in a sense, if it was, it was covert, although, you know, the interpretations differ among observers.
Yep.
But here we have 64 secretive or attempted secret changes, 30% of which, by the way, you say actually the U.S. wasn't really fingered at the time. In other words, the attempt was made, but it wasn't found out. Is that mainly because the regime change didn't actually happen in those cases? Do you know that offhand?
There's really 2 reasons. In some of the cases, it was when the U.S. meddled in elections and the party supported by the United States
uh-huh.
won the election. So they have no incentive to reveal that they were getting funding from the United States.
Good point. Yeah.
Yes. And then in some other cases, when we were targeting Soviet allies, they understood that the U.S. was trying to overthrow it, but either they had infiltrated the operation and were trying to keep that knowledge secret so they could learn more about it, or they were afraid that if they, you know, accused the U.S. of overthrowing them, people would think they had more of a resistance movement at the time. So they kept it secret for the United States, actually.
It's actually a good reminder for me. One way that a covert operation happens is you try to meddle in the election of
yeah.
the other country. You fund the campaign or you repress the opposition or you put in fake news or something like that. And
yeah.
then when one of the parties wins and perhaps the one backed by the United States, they do not have an incentive to say, hey, the United States put us in power. So that's a reason why it could actually remain secret
yes, yeah.
for quite a while, in fact.
Yes, 16 of my cases was the U.S. meddling in foreign elections, and the U.S.-backed forces came to power in 12 of those cases. You know, countries like Italy, France, Japan, at the start of the Cold War. So, of course, these governments would have no incentive to say that they were getting American support at the time.
Right. Yeah, that's a good reminder that some of these cases are, you know, the European countries after World War II. There were large popular communist parties. After all, the Soviet Union had been an ally of the United States in World War II, a victorious ally. And the communist parties of Italy and France were very popular, and it was U.S. policy to prevent them from coming to power, even though we ostensibly were saying this is a democracy and it's open competition.
Yes, that's exactly right. I mean, part of our containment policy at the time.
So 64 cases, and remind us of all the different methods that could be used and that the U.S. Has used in those 64 cases.
Assassinations. So we had three assassination attempts. None of them succeeded, actually, although several foreign leaders were killed inadvertently during U.S.-backed coups, Diem and Trujillo.
We had Diem in Vietnam in 1963, Trujillo in 61, was it?
Yes, in the Dominican Republic, yes.
In 1961 in the Dominican Republic. And those were coups where the U.S. Sided with the plotters locally, and then those plots ended up with the assassination of the leader, not necessarily pushed by the U.S., maybe yes or no. There is the famous story of John F. Kennedy learning that in the coup, which he knew about against the South Vietnamese leader in, I think, September 1963, he is whispered in the ear that Diem has been killed, and he runs out of the room, you know, blanched, almost nauseous from what has happened, to learn that it ended up in an assassination. It was supposed to end up in a coup.
Yes. There's actually a White House tape you can listen to before he's assassinated. So Diem dies, I think, on November 3rd, and Kennedy, of course, is on the 22nd. And in the meantime, Kennedy was taking notes for his memoirs, and he talks about the assassination, and he's very upset, and it's a very human moment. And then his son walks in, and he starts playing with his son in the middle. And then his son walks away, and he goes back to talking about the coup. It's just a real, you know, human moment. Yeah.
So it can be done, assassination, a coup.
Yes.
A election meddling.
Yes. During the Cold War, probably the most famous example would be supporting Solidarity in Poland in the 1980s. The same type of idea. And then finally, supporting armed dissidents, which was actually the most common one. We had 35 attempts to do that. Only four of them actually brought the U.S.-backed forces to power.
Wow. Really?
Yeah.
Of all those insurgencies, that's very interesting because it creates a lot of commotion and a lot of destruction and unrest, but not very successful. So 64 cases all over the world, by the way. Of those 64, what was the track record? You distinguish between short-term and long-term track record. So short-term is just, did the operation replace the government?
So only 39% of the cases in the short-term did the U.S.-backed forces come to power, 25 cases. And here I found there was a number of different things that, you know, suggested why it was likely to succeed or not. One thing was the nature of the targeted state. It was much easier to overthrow weak states. It was easier to overthrow American allies. It was easier to intervene in democracies, which sort of suggests that paradoxically, the places where we were most likely to succeed with covert actions were actually the ones where we needed to do the least. And when we tried to go against the Soviet Union or its adversaries, we were much less successful. I think we had a 10% success rate against Soviet allies, 43% success rate against non-aligned state, but a 70% success rate against American allies. And another thing that mattered a lot was trying to compare the relative balance of forces between the U.S.-backed forces and the party in power. Covert operations were most likely to succeed when basically they just had to tip the scale a little bit in that party's favor. They may have won anyway. In a lot of the cases, like in the election meddling, they were leading in the polls before the U.S. backed them. So it's hard to say that the U.S. was the definitive source. It was simply just much, much more difficult to successfully overthrow a state when you were going up trying to overthrow a powerful state.
When you started to collect this database, did you have any expectation of how many cases you were going to find?
No.
Did the number surprise you as being high, and my God, I didn't know that they intervened there, or it was kind of what you and your advisor, John Mearsheimer, expected?
No, it just kept on creeping up. Before I did this, you know, just studying U.S. foreign policy, you know about Guatemala and Iran and Chile and the famous cases. And so I thought maybe there'd be 20 cases or something. And then it just kept on creeping up the more I did it. And yeah, that really kind of is remarkable to me.
So you share my feeling is, my God, 64 cases. Are you kidding? And just meddling everywhere.
Yeah.
And my sense, by the way, is meddling in places we don't understand very much, don't have very strong stakes in often, you know, places where there's almost no American business, almost no American history, almost no American footprint, but just, oh, we got to do something in Iraq. We have to do something in this place. We have to do something in that place. How do you explain that? It's quite an attitude, actually.
Well, I think the thinking in Washington was that covert operations are really cheap. You know, the U.S. isn't putting boots on the ground. It's somebody else who's doing the heavy lifting of overthrowing the regime, and will take the retaliation if they get caught. Economically, they're a fraction of the cost of trying to put U.S. boots on the ground. Reputationally, they think they can do things that will go against, you know, things the United States wouldn't want to publicly do. And so they think the costs are very low. And because the costs are just so low, they think they might as well attempt these things, even if they're, you know, not terribly likely to succeed.
We don't like it very much when ostensibly another country interferes in our domestic politics.
Yes.
Is that right?
Of course. I mean, look what happened to the United States after accusations of Russian meddling in the 2016 election, you know, really helped to increase threat inflation against Russia. But I don't know. I think American policymakers would be wise to understand how these things are viewed by the other countries. They don't like having their politics meddled in either, and it increases anti-Americanism and
you don't find
trust.
A lot of self-reflection on that in the record, do you?
I can't say I do. No, there's surprisingly little learning when it comes to this. One of the kind of remarkable things is that throughout the Cold War, there was a number of times when the CIA commissioned or the president commissioned a study of the covert actions, and they all came to the same conclusions that these things don't really work. They weren't worth the investment of resources versus the blowback they got to it. And despite being warned, they just kind of did this time and again. You know, Kennedy was warned right before he did the Bay of Pigs. Nixon did the same thing. Even Obama, before he decided to go into Syria in 2012, he commissioned a study by the CIA that basically said the same thing.
Wow.
And yet he decided to go in it as well. I think it's just the idea. It gives you the ability to do something.
I obviously have not studied it remotely like you have, but in my work, of course, I've come across it nonstop for the last 40 years. And the thing that has amazed me is how casually it was done in some cases. Again, I don't know because I've never gone necessarily to the core, almost never to primary data or, you know, to the archives. But for example, the CIA engagement in the assassination of Lumumba, who was the popular democratic leader of the first independent government of what became the Democratic Republic of Congo. At the time, it was the Belgian Congo, and then it gained independence. And Lumumba was a very bright, charismatic, popular young leader. And from what I understand, there was a meeting in the White House, and one of Eisenhower's advisors said, you know, the guy leans to the Soviets and isn't safe. And Eisenhower said, well, finish them up. It was as casual as that. Really, spook story stuff, not in a deep, profound, my God, what will the implications be, but rather casually carried out.
I don't think that's always the case, but in a lot of cases it is, you know. It's actually kind of interesting. You often see that, you know, these decisions are made at the highest levels in the White House, and you can see sort of cavalier thinking on the behalf of the president and National Security Council. Although many times, if you looked at the CIA, the CIA agents who were actually in charge of the country, who had a much better understanding of what was actually going on, were much more hesitant of these things because they actually understood the stakes better, which is kind of interesting. The CIA is sometimes considered, you know, this rogue elephant rampaging out of control, in the words of Frank Church. But at least in these cases, you know, a lot of times they were kind of an ignored voice, sort of warning about the repercussions.
Yeah, I think it's very interesting. And I concur with you on that these are not rogue operations. They typically come from the Oval Office, actually.
Yeah.
Presidents are typically engaged in a decision like this. They can be rather casual, as the one that I cited. And there's another famous one. I don't know if you studied it. I think it's Jagan was the Democratic leader of Guyana, if I have it correctly.
Yeah.
And there's a famous story, I don't know if I have it right, but of Kennedy and Kennedy's advisor, Arthur Schlesinger Jr., meeting with Jagan in the White House. And this was a young independence leader of his country, which was going to gain independence in 1961. And he makes a remark at the end about some Marxist article in the Monthly Review. He's led out of the Oval Office, and Schlesinger says, you know, this guy could be another Castro. He's dangerous. I think we should get rid of him. And 4 weeks later, he's overthrown in according to your typology, in a manufactured unrest, general strike, violence, and so forth. And then what is an unbelievable event, 30 years later, I think to the year, this gentleman had since the overthrow become the prime minister of his country several times. He was highly respected. And he showed up one day, I think in 1991, if I remember correctly, at the Council on Foreign Relations. And Arthur Schlesinger Jr., now an old man, shows up and listens to him and then stands up in the back of the room and says, you know, I'm here to make an apology to you.
Oh, I didn't know this.
Yeah. This is apparently a true story. Schlesinger says 30 years ago, you walked out of the Oval Office and I suggested to the president, we take you out. And I'm here to apologize for that.
Oh, my God. I did not know that. That's amazing.
So I wanted to ask you about the CIA, not as a rogue elephant, but as the actual agent for these operations. How often the CIA shows up in your 64 cases? I didn't see a number, and maybe you didn't have a number, but is it the main instrument that the U.S. has used or did use over a certain period of time? Because afterwards, it started using different instruments like the National Endowment for Democracy and so forth.
Yeah, I think that characterization is correct. In my cases, I think virtually all of them have the CIA as the primary actor. It's just at the end of the Cold War that you start seeing the National Endowment for Democracy, and you see the U.S. trying to exert influence in this, I don't know how to call it, pseudo-covert way through the National Endowment for Democracy. But during the Cold War, they were overwhelmingly the dominant.
Yeah, the thing that always impressed me about not in the in the glorification, but in the mistake of U.S. foreign policy was in 1947 in the National Security Act, the CIA was created with literally two extremely distinct roles. One was as an intelligence operation. It is the Central Intelligence Agency. And there I have, generally, yeah, of course, the country needs an intelligence operation in a complex world. But it was also created as almost a presidential army, that it was something that was accountable to the president. It could do covert operations. And that's quite different from the intelligence operation. And I know that Truman wrote about this later, and apparently even at the time that he was signing it, I think he said to Dean Acheson that this doesn't feel right to give this general power to the CIA, or maybe not to the CIA, to the president, because the president became the leader of a secret army, not accountable to the public, certainly, able to carry out covert operations, most of which still got pinned on the CIA, because very hard to do this stuff really secretly, but I would say almost totally unaccountably.
Yeah. That I think is a fair characterization. I mean, with the intelligence reforms in the 1970s, there were some efforts to exert congressional control over it. Although, at least for the rest of the Cold War, they didn't exert that much control over it. You know, I think they didn't necessarily want to take a very active role in doing it. So it kind of remained just a vessel of presidential power.
Did you do your own Freedom of Information Act at all, or you were able to just get the declassified files?
Yeah, I did a ton of Freedom of Information Act requests.
Did they come through?
Some. There's particularly at the 1980s, the Reagan Library, there's just such a backlog. I put in a number of requests and I would get a letter back and it literally said that it would be in 14 years.
Oh my God.
So I couldn't wait to publish the book. So, you know, I just had to go with what I had. But there is a lot of publicly available things. If you do look, you can look at the Foreign Relations of the United States series online. It has a lot of these documents. And the CIA Electronic Reading Room is really useful as well. Yeah, I had to do a lot of either in the archives or FOIA requests to get what I have.
Were people ready to speak with you about these things?
Yeah, they were actually pretty eager. I think by the time I wrote, because it was Cold War stuff, I met a lot of older CIA officers, and they were quite forthcoming, spoke about it quite openly and honestly.
Did they generally tell you, don't use my name, but I'll fill you in on the background?
Yeah, basically. Yeah. Uh-huh. And I'd have them look at my cases and is there anything else I missed? And
Wow. They
gave me some advice on, you know, why they thought certain operations succeeded or failed.
So let's go through the successes and failures. 25 successes, you say?
Yes. Yeah.
Not great, by the way, out of, successes in quotation marks, I want to emphasize, because success is not only in the eye of the beholder, it depends on the definition of what success means. In this case, it means that the U.S. replaced the government as it sought to do.
Yeah, you know, I went further too, and I looked to see when we did succeed, when we did overthrow the government, did that ultimately achieve America's foreign policy aims? And here I found largely it didn't. And it's just very difficult to actually change the policy preferences of another state. You know, a lot of times before the operation, you would have somebody approach the CIA or the United States and say that, you know, they have the support in this country. If you install me, I will act in your interest. But the reality is, if you look at the subset of international disputes that become, that sort of escalate to the point of covert regime change, it's normally that there's a very intractable problem between the target state and the United States. You know, it's something very difficult. And for the weak state not to acquiesce to the United States when they're trying to resolve it via coercion, they really had to have persuasive reasons not to. Either they, you know, their international environment, or they had powerful domestic constituencies demanding it. And so what happened in a lot of these cases is we installed the new regime, and once they were in power, they faced the same exact, you know, pressures as their successors. And so they're then in this bind. Do they either, you know, turn against the United States in order to appease domestic constituencies, which many of them did? Or do they turn against domestic constituencies in order to appease the United States and kind of just use U.S. aid to stay in power? Think of the Shah of Iran. The problem is that when you do this, it tended to generate like a lot of nationalist backlash to them, understandably. Nobody likes their rulers to be seen as a puppet of the United States. And more than 50% of the leaders installed by the United States were later violently removed by power from assassination, a coup, or revolution.
Yeah, that's extraordinary. And I want people to follow that. 25 cases out of the 64 replaced the government in the way the U.S. intended, but then so often disaster followed. And like you said, I think you make a very basic and very important point, which is that the U.S. has a lot of power over weaker governments. It's got economic power. It can bribe leaders. It can coerce leaders. It can impose sanctions. It can do all sorts of things. So that by the time you get to a regime change, the U.S. is trying to do something that probably has a lot of resistance in
exactly.
that other place. And so the mere fact that you put someone else in the seat of power means relatively little about actually changing the policies, whether it's right or wrong to have, whether what the U.S. wants is right or wrong for them or for the United States. Even putting that aside, just very cynically and in a hard-nosed way, the U.S. couldn't change that country's policy through normal pressure. So it had to resort, it chose to resort to something absolutely extreme, replace the government. And then lo and behold, civil war, assassinations, coups. What a mess.
Another thing I looked at was the effects on the target state themselves, not just their relations with the United States. And there, the picture is just grim. Successful operations decrease the likelihood of democratization. Across the board, increase the likelihood of civil war, increase the likelihood of government-sponsored mass killings, whether the operation succeeded or failed. And so, you know, for the target states themselves, obviously just terrible things. You're going in, you're messing with their infrastructure, their political infrastructure, you're empowering different domestic groups, inflaming passions. So it's, yeah, quite negative.
Do you have a sense of how many other power, it has to be a big power to be engaged in this kind of thing? Soviet Union presumably did this. Of course, Russia perhaps now. Is there any data comparable to yours looking at what other countries are doing in this area and comparing the U.S. proclivities in this regard to those of other countries?
There is. Unfortunately, there's not an international data set. It's just simply other states don't have the openness of the U.S. system. Rory Cormack in the U.K. has done a great study of U.K. interventions since World War II.
We learned a lot from the U.K., actually.
Yes, they were we did.
The big empire before us.
Exactly. And we did many of these operations alongside them, actually. So he has a great study, at least during the, you know, my study. In many of the interventions, particularly in, you know, non-aligned countries, the Soviets were on the other side. And so I can say that they did a great number of cases as well. But yeah, I think it largely a tool of great powers. I suspect, although I couldn't prove, that some states like France might intervene in their former colonies and so forth today. But unfortunately, I don't have the data to...
Yeah, but basically, probably mostly U.S., Russia... or Soviet Union, Britain, for sure,
yeah.
France, the colonial powers, basically. And yeah. I always feel the United States learned its handiwork from the British Empire. And still, the British Empire is the biggest cheerleader of all of this stuff. They really have a James Bond complex, it seems to me. But actually, they continued to do it, in fact, for a while before losing all relevant power, I would say.
Yeah. Can I ask you a question, if you don't mind?
Of course.
In your work in the post-Cold War, you know, you said that you've encountered many of these things on the ground in your own experience. What did that look like? How did you become aware of them?
Well, there are, you know, some cases, for instance, in Haiti, just as an example, President Aristide asked me to help him with economic advice. And he said to me at one point, you know, they're going to take me out. And I was really surprised. You know, I'm an economist. I'm not a spook. And I said, no, everything's going to be fine. He said, no, they're going to take me out. And it didn't even process properly with me. And then it started. First, the U.S. cut off all of Haiti's access to the World Bank, the Inter-American Development Bank, all the economic pressures. Aristide remained popular. And then literally one day, U.S.-backed troops, you know, crossed the border from the Dominican Republic. And the U.S. ambassador walked up to Aristide's door and said, well, we happen to have an unmarked plane. We can save your life. You have to get in it. And 23 hours later, Aristide was in Central African Republic. You know, he'd been overthrown in broad daylight.
Yeah.
And what was fascinating to me in that, first, it was extremely distressing and depressing. It was a coup in broad daylight, masterminded by the U.S. No pickup in the U.S. at all. So it's a case of a covert operation that, you know, was not really covert, but no attention. So I called the New York Times and I talked to the reporter on the beat.
Yeah.
And I said, are you going to cover this story? The president was just overthrown in broad daylight. Nah, my editor's not so interested. So they never covered it. Then I testified in the House, it was, the next week, saying this was a coup. And everyone else looked at me like I was crazy, you know. Oh, we love Haiti. We care so much. And so this was a case, because no one in the U.S. cared about Aristide, where the coup happened and there wasn't even a ruffle. There wasn't even a news story afterwards. So that was one example. I had a strange experience with the Maidan with Ukraine.
Yeah.
Because after Yanukovych, the Ukraine president, was overthrown, and I didn't know what was going on. I wasn't advising any of the governments. I hadn't worked in the region for 2 decades, actually. But I got a call the next day that the new prime minister wants to meet you. And I said, okay, you know, my job is to help with the economic crisis. So I actually flew to Kyiv to meet. And I was shown around the Maidan by an NGO, quote unquote, which told me about all of the American money that went into this operation on the Maidan. And it really turned my stomach, I have to tell you. I had my meeting and I went home and I understood how deep the U.S. engagement was. And it really made me sick, actually, until today. And that was before the release of the tape of Victoria Nuland on tape with the U.S. ambassador, Jeffrey Piat, planning who the post-Yanukovych government would be. What's fascinating is, of course, Nuland picked the person I met. And that call was about 3 weeks before the actual event took place. We didn't know about it till the Russians did the interception, posted it, so we could listen to what the U.S. was doing. But even till today, Lindsay, even though what I saw directly with my own eyes was so disgusting, frankly, it's still, when I say the U.S. was part of a coup, oh no, that was a popular uprising.
So that's, and dignity.
Yeah, so that's really an example to me of a narrative which is preposterous, because how much more vivid can you get than being on tape saying, no, that one stays out, this one comes in, that one's the prime minister. You know, it's like a bad joke. But even in broad daylight, they have a narrative way of just fluffing over this, because again, the New York Times or the other mainstream media won't report this stuff.
Yeah.
So those are the kinds of examples that I've seen. And sometimes I've been in places where I haven't understood things swimming around me because I didn't really understand, you know, what the National Endowment for Democracy was or wasn't doing and how elections were or weren't manipulated. I tend to come in when a government asks me for financial or macroeconomic advice.
Yeah.
So I don't see the undercurrent, but then you hear a lot because I've been involved at the UN for more than 20 years. You also hear a lot. Another example, one of the shocking cases of covert regime change for me is the Obama-led attempt to overthrow Bashar al-Assad in Syria.
Yeah.
And this started in 2011. You talk about the presidential finding, Operation Timber Sycamore, which starts in 2012, where the CIA is instructed to train the opposition forces and so forth. So I didn't know about that at the time, of course, but I did know the senior UN diplomats that were trying to negotiate peace in Syria in 2012, because Kofi Annan had been asked to be the special envoy of the UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon, who I was advising. And I had advised Kofi Annan personally, also as his special advisor for many, many years. And they explained to me the U.S. was completely blocking the peace accord that everyone else agreed with. And when you hear it at the most inside level, you'd never read about this.
But in any of the stories.
So these are the ways that I come to see this.
Yeah.
You know, I find it, of course, the difference, I love your advisor, as you may know, John Mearsheimer. You know, I think he's such a great political scientist. But I am still enamored of the idea, which he thinks is very naive, that we could have international law, we could have the UN Charter working. So I'm a believer in all of that, because I think we need to. And I always say to John, you know, your greatest book, which is a great, great book, is The Tragedy of Great Power Politics. And I don't want a tragedy. A comedy would be okay. Or
I say that same thing to him all the time. Like, it's the tragedy, John.
Right. No, exactly. So I'm trying to get past the tragedy. So I like international law. He says, Jeff, come on. Say, no, international law can really work. So this is the debate that we have all the time.
No, I liked it in your book. I mean, I think in your book on American exceptionalism, you make a powerful case that, you know, there's these very pressing problems, climate change. We're not going to fix it unless we have an international solution. So yeah. I really appreciated your book.
Thank you. You know, this is the sense that I find all of this really troublesome. And I think the blowback for me, and your book is so powerful in this also, in helping people to understand the scale, the dangers, and everything else. And maybe American leaders even mean it, although I'm not, you're never sure what they mean, but they say to Russia, why are you concerned about NATO being in Ukraine? And we're peace-loving and so forth. If we weren't, okay, I'm going to use a strong word, I don't want to put it in your mouth, but if we weren't addicted to regime change, maybe such an attitude would be credible. But for another country's point of view, when they see the U.S. behave repeatedly in this way, it doesn't seem so peace-loving. It seems like, well, that's a good way to lose your sovereignty, is to have the U.S. next door. So to my mind, it deeply undermines the possibilities of cooperation in the world.
No, I concur with you. it's hard to agree with Putin on many things, but when you think about it from the Russian perspective, that the U.S. has this very long history that they're very intimately aware of, and they see the color revolutions as being promoted by the United States. They see the U.S. intervening in Ukraine. It's very, from their perspective, you can understand why they would have perceived this in an offensive way, why they would think that National Endowment for Democracy funds in Russia was aimed to try to overthrow Moscow. So you can see why they have little faith in the United States and why they were so worried.
It's another case when you ask me, you know, how I hear this. I hear leaders tell me they're out to get me, you know, whether it's a National Endowment for Democracy or other groups that I won't mention that are part of all of this. And I agree with them, by the way, because I know the story, because I've read your book, because I see what's going on. And I think the deepest point is, first, the failures are clear and you document them. The successes turn into failures with an absolutely alarming rate. But the poison to the international milieu, because everything looks like it's a conspiracy this way, even those that aren't by the time you're done with it, means that we've really undermined the path to cooperation. Now, I want to end by urging you to bring this up to date to 2023. I know it's hard because you were able to get so much information because of the lag of time, but your work is extraordinarily important and the systematic database is unique, and anything you can do to help fill it in, I think, you know, is a huge service for the world.
Well, I might be hitting you up to hear more of your stories because they're remarkable. Thank you so much. It really was a pleasure being here.
Yeah, thank you. It's been great to speak with you. We've been speaking with Lindsay O'Rourke on Covert Regime Change, America's Secret Cold War, a most remarkable book. People are listening all over the world, and I know they're going to read your book and they're going to learn a tremendous amount. And let me say to everybody, thank you so much for tuning in with us today. And I hope and expect you've enjoyed today's episode. Please remember to subscribe for the future content, for future book club episodes. And if you have a moment, please leave a review. I can't tell you how much we value your support and participation. And so until the next time, take care. Thank you again. And join us again for Book Club with Jeffrey Sachs.